Welcome to Alpha Trader. We have a special double bill today in honor of Wild Card Weekend. Coming up on the show, Eddie Elfenbein of Crossing Wall Street, giving us his top five new stocks for 2021. But first, we are pleased to welcome back to the show Ryan Dietrich. He is Chief Market Strategist for LPL Financial. Ryan, welcome back to Alpha Trader.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for having me. I didn't realize I was getting the seat warm for Eddie. I'm a big fan of Eddie, so that's...
We are, yeah.
I'll try to say anything that Eddie would have said then, because sometimes Eddie and I kind of go down the same avenue the way we look at the world, but that's awesome, so I'm glad.
I know Eddie's a hard act to
follow. Honored to be here today.
Yeah, I know he's a hard act to follow, so that's why, you know, we had you on first. it was really about schedules and timing, but also, you know, I thought it'd be a great... You know, with you giving us the big technical picture and he's a bottom-up stock picker is a good, yep. You know, two sides of the coin here. So let's talk about, you know, technically speaking, how things look from your perspective. You know, of course, last week, the Dow breaking above 31,000 for the first time, the S&P and NASDAQ hitting new milestones at 3,800 and 13,000. Now we're talking Monday, midday. There's a bit of weakness in the stock market. Bitcoin and some of the other cryptocurrencies are having some more significant weakness as we're talking here. Technically speaking, how does the stock market look to you overall right now?
Yeah, I mean, Aaron, let's just take a step back to last year for just a second, though, right? At the lows last year, down 34% off the highs, then you finish higher, up about 16% for the S&P 500, that is. That's the greatest reversal we've ever seen. We've never seen a 30% correction with stocks finishing higher. Previous times was 2009, something we saw similar to that. And one of the big themes we've laid out at LPL Research is, listen, this has been an incredible rally. We're aware of that. But you mentioned technicals. I mean, look at financials. Financials have literally gone nowhere for 13 years. Emerging markets have literally gone nowhere for 13 years. Japan is breaking out the 31-year highs, still nowhere near the 89 highs. I mean, this is a, to put a bow on it, we can get into more details. I mean, we think this is a really healthy bull market. I came on with you guys in the middle of the pandemic. You know, we laid out some reasons to be optimistic. Did I really believe them at the time? Hey, it was tough, but you know, things have played out. You know, I mean, things have really, really played out so well. And so many of the things that we were talking about at LPL Research was just a strength that we saw off those lows is consistent with the start of a new bull market. And I get it. People say, how in the world with all the devastating headlines last week and you know, what did we just lose? Another, you know, lost jobs last month and the things continue to be negative. Yet the market doesn't care about our feelings. The market is looking to the future. And I think that it sees more stimulus. It sees a Fed that's still there. You mentioned technicals. Advanced decline lines are still strong. Credit spreads are still fairly tight. Credit markets aren't worried about what's going on. The 10-year yield finally above the 1% rank. You wouldn't think that's much. But all these things really to us suggest this is a new bull market and continued strength potentially for years. I know that sounds crazy, but strength potentially for years is kind of how we see this playing out.
Right. No. And first of all, to take a step back, yes, you did make that call in the midst of the pandemic, and I'm sure it was very difficult. It was almost hard to hear at the time, and obviously worked out, you know, very well. And that's an understatement because the last 9 months of 2020 were incredible if you were long. Do you have any concerns, though, that things have gotten frothy, you know, even just in the short term?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Bitcoin, and like I told you before, I'm not really allowed to talk about cryptocurrencies, but you kind of have these bubbles that are taking place in certain areas. You got all these IPOs, you do have the big move in the cryptocurrencies, you got put the call ratio showing a lot of excitement. I mean, in the near term, Aaron, absolutely, after a 65, 66% rally, even more, you know, with small caps and tech, I mean, hey, a pullback makes sense. And we've laid this chart down. If you look at how the 2009 bull market started compared to this one, they've almost been lockstep. All right. I mean, because remember that started in March 2009, big rally. What happened in 2010? You had a 10% correction early in the year, then a rally back to new highs, then a 16% correction in the summer. We wouldn't be shocked at all. Again, if you had kind of two different 10% corrections this year, maybe even more, you know, after the massive, massive gains that we saw last year, it's really amazing at kind of how things played out, obviously last year on so many different levels, but now we're getting a little more normalcy. And again, the playbook is what happened in 2010, and that's kind of some choppiness, but at the end of the day, probably more highs. And then the whole big, the big question is, you know, value versus growth. We've liked growth for a long time at LPL Research. We just released our, or by the time people hear this, we'll have released our recent weekly market commentary. We've definitely started to warm significantly more to value, you know, as the cyclicals take over, materials, industrials. I mean, being overweight growth has been a really nice place to be for a few years, but we are seeing some changes maybe that say at least maybe it's time to even up your value versus growth. And that's kind of how we're positioning the models that we run for our more than 17,000 advisors as we look out into the future and into 2022.
And you mentioned a couple of bubbly areas. I'll talk about one more, and that's the EV stocks and Tesla specifically as it relates to the market. Tesla's now in the S&P 500, running an $800 billion plus market cap for some reason. Given that, given its presence in the broad index now, Tesla could correct 50% and still maybe be wildly overvalued. What does that do to the S&P 500 performance?
Yeah, well, Elon Musk is the most wealthy man in America, or in the world, right? I think I saw some of those things trending. I guess that's, you know, thanks to Jeff Bezos for getting divorced, you know, because nonetheless, pretty amazing. Now, I guess a side note to the whole the crypto thing, I'm not really allowed to talk about individual equities either, I'm sorry. But what I can say is this, you know, you've got these, we've all heard about how, okay, there's the top five stocks, right? The FANG stocks, all these big super stocks that have been pulling us higher. You guys know small caps actually did better than large caps last year. The second half of last year, you've seen much more participation from some of the small and the micro cap areas, which again is a healthy sign of a bull market that there is participation. Now, you have some of these big names that are worth so much. And again, we all know who they are, the FANG stocks and the ticker you just mentioned. You know, there could be a well-deserved pullback there, but where are those? Those are the large cap tech areas. Those are the areas that have got us to the dance, that got us to the party. We still like them, but hey, you know, we've warmed a lot to small caps. We've taken a look at market history, and you know, 12 months to 18 months off of new expansions, where again we think we're in a new expansion. We do think this recession likely ended late last summer. Oh, it's not official yet, but it's likely. Small caps do way, way better. So small caps are an area that, yeah, if some of the other areas have done well. I know small caps just had their best quarter ever, right? If Russell 2000 just had his best quarter in history in the fourth quarter, it also just broke out the new highs above 2018 last quarter. So it's not like on a bigger basis they're just wildly overvalued or overbought, in our opinion. Maybe a pullback makes sense, but small caps are an area. If you're concerned about large caps, hey, we warmed a lot to those early in this new cycle of growth.
Right. So it's interesting. You touched upon something, you know, for technicians, a lot of it depends on what kind of charts you're looking at, the time frame. How do you approach it? So, because if I look at small caps, right, so they just broke out of from 2018 base, I guess you could call it, to new high. So that's very bullish. But you know, up 35% in 10 weeks, that might scare you a little bit on a shorter term horizon. So can you talk a little bit about your methodology and how you would look at something like that?
Sure. I guess, yeah, I mean, get a little cliche on you, but wait for your pitch, right? I mean, we have team meetings all the time with our 30-person research team, and we're talking about, hey, we like small caps. We upgraded small caps in September, for instance. Now, do we add it in all the different portfolios we run for our advisors? No. And then it takes off. But we still like the group, and we're willing to wait for some type of a well-deserved pullback or correction in small caps. We think it'll happen in the first half of this year, so we're willing to wait for it. Now, I do want to tell a quick story of this. I call it the seven-year itch. If you look at cyclical bull markets, all right, I think, in my opinion, a cyclical bull market was 1950 to 1968. 7 years in, we all know about the seven-year itch. People get tired of things after 7 years. There was a bear market and a recession in 1957. People say the 82 to 2000 bull market. Disagree. New highs were made in 80, 30% gain in 80. I think that bull market started 1980 to 2000. 7 years in, 87 crash. What happened after both those times, though? Significant gains after the seven-year itch took place. Fast forward to right now. This bull market didn't start in 2009. It started in 2013. Getting technical again, that's when we broke above the 2000-2007 peak in 2013 after going nowhere for 13 years. Add 7 to 13, you get 2020. Hey, you know, Mark Twain said history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. That's the seven-year itch. We had the incredible correction bear market last year, recession last year. But if history and these secular bull markets continue, which we think it will, there could be, again, potentially years of growth. And look at the areas I've gone over for 13 years, emerging markets, financial, some of those other areas. Those could really be the ones that kind of lead the second half of what, again, we think can be a longer-term bull market.
Right. And I'm glad you came back to that, because a theme of this podcast last year, Steve and I would ask a lot of guests, you know, it feels like we maybe were in somewhere in the late 1990s. Is it 1996 or 1999? Yeah. And we had one guest, John Markman of Markham Capital, said, actually, I think 2009 is a better analogy. And he was looking, I believe it was a 5X from the lows in terms of a long-term price target. But basically what he was saying is that we were at the start of a new, and Jeff Sott also, Capital Wealth Advisor, saying it's a new secular bull market. That's effectively, that's what I'm hearing you say as well, that what we saw in March was the beginning of a new bull market that's likely to go on for several years. Am I hearing that correctly?
No, absolutely. I mean, yes. I mean, again, I mean, these secular bull markets last decades, and again, 7 years in, you get a correction. We think this secular bull market started in 2013, okay? So you can say it's 7 or 8 years in, but it can last a lot longer. Let's think of it like this. The last economic cycle of growth was 11 years, all right? 6 years, the one before that, 10 years, the one before that, 8 years, the one before that. This cycle of growth is what, maybe 4 or 5 months old? So history would say, again, this economic cycle of growth could have years left. And we've seen the numbers and we understand the data. If you have economic growth, you tend to have stock market outperformance also. So that's just another different way of showing this is probably the beginning of something much better. And again, we're going to have dips. It's going to be volatile. Again, we have a 10% correction, 16% correction like 2010. It's going to feel really sickening when that happens. But again, it's an opportunity for longer term investors to get their portfolios right and hopefully continue to make some really nice gains for their long term future goals.
That's a really good point. I know you're talking very long term, and just because you think we're in a big secular bull market does not mean we can have some sizable dips in between. And I'm thinking kind of the recent performance of small caps and some of the action, it might be pricing in kind of another very sizable fiscal stimulus bill, including some big checks to individuals and not just corporations. And that might be getting priced in. And I'm wondering if it actually does not happen. We heard some chatter from a Democratic senator last week, Manchin, who might be a deciding vote, saying he's not interested in that. Maybe that's our next correction. Maybe that's our next time to kind of get in there and buy the dip.
No, it absolutely could be. And I'll tell you, wouldn't it be a good time to be a moderate right now? The moderate, like I said, Manchin from West Virginia, you mentioned the moderate. I mean, the moderates have a lot of power right now when you consider the fact that, as we all know, the Senate is 50-50. And I know the tiebreaker goes to the vice president, but 50-50 is still 50-50. And then you go look at the House, and the Democrats have an 11-seat, as of now, 11-seat advantage in the House. That is the smallest margin in 100 years. I mean, the truth is we have a divided Congress. We have a divided country. But the other truth to this is stock markets tend to do well when you have that division. We've all heard this and seen this before. It's the honest to goodness truth. And you mentioned stimulus. I mean, the stimulus is not going anywhere. Yes, maybe there's some hard talk there, but we did look at the jobs number that happened just on Friday, right? Weaker than expected. I mean, we think there's likely going to be some type of, and the terrible things that happened last Wednesday. We think Washington understands we can't have that happen again. There's division. Maybe Washington can work together more than anyone thought they could have before what happened on Wednesday, and get the stimulus to help the people that are so, I mean, what, 500,000 people in the hospitality leisure area lost their jobs just in December. I mean, that's horrible. So people are still really struggling with this. And then we need that more stimulus to help them. And markets like spending, markets like stimulus. And that's partially another reason why moving stocks can do well. The other is this earnings season coming up, guys. These last two earnings seasons came in way better than expected. So we think earnings should do good still.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because I guess it was early December. You guys put out your outlook for 2021, and we were forecasting then S&P 500 earnings growth of 25% in 21, boosted by cost efficiencies achieved during the pandemic. That's an end quote. So does that suggest that there's still valuation growth that could come, or is that already priced in with the S&P 500 as we're talking here at around 3,800?
Yeah, I mean, one of our concerns, you know, Aaron, about this coming into this year right now is valuations are high. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Valuations are historically high. Luckily, inflation and rates are low, so that kind of justifies it to a degree. But we think it's going to most of the stock growth that comes this year is going to have to come from earnings growth. And we wouldn't be shocked at all if earnings came in a little bit better than kind of what we're expecting there. I mean, I know all the negative things, right? We know that. But animal spirits are a powerful thing with what the Fed's doing and stimulus is doing. We think, you know, these last two earnings seasons really historic by historically wide margins. And we wouldn't be surprised at all if that kind of continued and that justified kind of this, honestly, this record run that we've seen over the past, we'll call it 9 months or so.
Is there anything out there that could get you to change your mind to make you more cautious?
Oh, I mean, yeah, absolutely. You know, the one thing I mentioned, you know, I guess inflation, right? A lot of people are talking about inflation, all the stimulus is out there. The Fed's already said they're going to wait till inflation finally shows up before they finally hike rates. That's a major change. They announced that back in August. So, you know, you look at these commodities that are just going bonkers and some of these things. If more inflation creeps up, could that potentially be the, you know, break the camel's back, so to speak? That'd be one thing that worries us. You know, market sentiment, though, like I talked about a little bit ago, is awfully frothy. People are feeling good compared to when we had, you know, the Economist with the cover story, the week of the lows in March, it said closed, right? I mean, right. I know, you know, that's what came out at the lows. People aren't quite feeling that way now. And from that contrarian point of view, a well-deserved market correction makes sense. But just bigger picture, guys, when we see advanced decline line strong, participation with the fiscal and monetary stimulus, it just still suggests that there's time to go and use those opportunities when stocks pull back. I've said it probably I've said with you guys, stock market's the only place where things go on sale, but people run out of the store screaming. We saw that last year, and it's the honest to goodness truth. And we really think, you know, that'll probably happen again. That's just psychology. But I think this was a real good reminder for investors. The stock market and the economy don't always jive. They didn't jive last year at all because the stock market was looking forward. And again, if you have longer term goals on your horizon, you can use these opportunities to try to, again, create some wealth long term and beat inflation.
All right. So you just mentioned, you know, prices fall and people run out of the room. So that I need to ask you about the dollar. Last week on this podcast, you know, I spoke publicly something I've been thinking about, that the dollar might be due for even if just a technical bounce, some kind of rebound, because everybody hates it. I know you're long-term negative on the dollar here. That's what your forecast was saying.
Yep.
But what is your take on the dollar here?
Yeah, we're not so lonely anymore. Right. We were dollar bears. You know, I mean, you know, you mentioned these big cycles, and I don't know why this happens, Aaron, but it does. 1985, 2001, 2017, 16-year cycles, U.S. dollar has a major, major peak and goes lower for about 7 to 8 years. We think we're in the midst of one of those, again, lower cycles of a lower dollar with a bear, dovish Fed and all the deficits that are out there. Even some of Joe Biden's policies are more weak U.S. dollar. But everybody knows that. The thing that we noted on Bloomberg, Bloomberg had U.S. dollar speculative bets the most since 2011. So a lot of people, that's bearish bets, I should say.
Right,
a lot of people are bearish the dollar here. So that contrarian in me does think maybe we start to see a bounce in the dollar that lasts, who knows, maybe 5 or 6 months, to be very honest. These things, it's like a cruise ship. It takes a while to move with the currencies. But still, bigger picture, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now, we think the dollar will likely be much lower. But and this is what we were saying, you know, a year ago, if we had these conversations, and the dollar is lower. But I do feel like we're not so lonely now. And that makes me think maybe some type of a little bit of a bounce would be perfectly normal in the midst of a longer term, lower structural trend in the dollar.
Okay. And as you wrote, a potentially weaker dollar would benefit U.S. multinationals, boost returns of international investments for dollar-based investors, and potentially provide support for commodity prices. I think you referenced this earlier. Copper had a huge year last year, right? You know,
yes.
Does Copper have a PhD? Right.
Dr. Copper. I mean, I don't know if Dr. Copper truly has a PhD, but what I do know is a lot of these electric vehicles use 3 to 4 times more copper than your regular car. China's buying copper. They're back on. You know, historically, higher trending copper leads to a higher trending 10-year yield. So you add it all up. And one of our favorite groups, again, not just this year, but even say 2, 3, 4 years from now, is those emerging markets. You and I, we talked about it a second ago. EM's gone nowhere for 13 years. It's just now breaking out. Remember that what I mentioned, the S&P 500 from 2000 to 2013 went nowhere. And that started finally the new secular bull market that, again, is about 8 years old now. We think emerging markets could be starting one of those new major secular trends. And for U.S. investors, we still like the U.S., yes. But we think having a little bit in emerging markets would make a lot of sense to find some alpha, some outperformance for your investments going forward several years. And those higher commodities are normally linked to emerging markets. It all just kind of plays in from a big macro point of view.
You kind of alluded to a little bit when I asked you what might change your opinion on or your positivity in the market. And you said, well, you know, I got my eye on inflation, but the Fed has made it clear they're not interested in hiking rates. I guess the 10-year note is up to about 1.13% today. It hadn't been above 1% since February or March. Let's say the Fed can't control that rate the way they can sit on short-term rates. Would a sharp rise in there to say, I don't know, 1.75 to 2% be of concern to you, or just tell you that, hey, the economy is really kind of revving up and that's actually good news?
Yeah, I think it depends how quickly it happens, right? If we're at 175 by, let's say, April Fool's Day, which would be an interesting April Fool's joke, that might be a little too soon. But if it's a year from now, that more slow and steady, and that's kind of our base case. We think the 10-year yield would be between 150 and 175 or so, you know, this time in about a year from now. So, you know, decent amount higher. But, you know, I like, again, looking at sentiment, you know, Bloomberg had a poll. They looked at 54 economists, and virtually nobody was expecting, you know, the 10-year yield to be up above 2%. All right. And I know that sounds really far away, but it was there a year ago this time. So I think one of the potential surprises, in my opinion, next year is a significantly higher 10-year yield, maybe up over 2%. And again, if it's more slow and steady, that'd be perfectly normal and healthy. If it happens real fast, that's when we have to worry a little bit.
Right. A healthy rise in rates as opposed to the sharp one that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right. It's not just the change, it's the speed at which something gets there, right, that the participants care about. And Ryan, you know, on that note, would rising yields, which seem to be good for the financials, which have perked up a little bit here at the end of Q4, what is your view on them as the financials as a sector here?
Yeah, I mean, financials, technically, as of the time we're recording this, we are still underweight financials here at LPL Research, but I'll tell you, we are actively looking at some of the things that we're seeing and considering upgrading that group. When you look at the cyclical value names we've all heard so much about, we like industrials and materials. And materials kind of plays on the EM theme, the higher commodities, industrials on the reopening theme. But again, we are strongly considering upgrading our view on financials and cyclical value in general. But at this time, we're still a little bit underweight financials in the models that we run. But next time we talk, I wouldn't be shocked if it's different.
Right. And I will note that this coming Friday, JP Morgan, Citigroup, Wells Fargo kicking off earnings season. So that'll be very interesting to see, obviously, what they report and more importantly, perhaps how the markets react.
Right.
All right. I guess it's been Ryan Dietrich, Chief Market Strategist for LPL Financial. Ryan, thanks as always for being with us.
Guys, thank you so much. I look forward to the next one. And tell Eddie I said hi.
That's right. That's a great intro coming up next. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Alpha Trader and our guest, Eddie Elfenbein of Crossing Wall Street. Welcome back to Alpha Trader. Stephen and I pleased to welcome back to the program Eddie Elfenbein. He is the author and editor of the Crossing Wall Street blog. His buy list has beaten the S&P 500 by over 70% the last 15 years. Eddie's also the manager of the Advisor Shares Focused Equity ETF, symbol CWS, which expresses his buy list. Eddie, great to have you back on Alpha Trader and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me back.
So primarily wanted to have you back to talk about the changes you made to your buy list, which you did at the end of last year, and talk about the specific names on that buy list. Before we do that, I do have to ask you a big picture question that you wrote about late last week, which a lot of people are asking themselves, and that is, are we in a bubble? What is your response to that idea that we've seen bubble-esque type activity here?
Well, it certainly does look like it, particularly in the stock market just had its best November and December period, I believe, on record, and we continue to go up in the midst of a coup attempt. And then you've seen ridiculous returns in Tesla and Bitcoin, becoming literally doubling in 1 month and then dropping $10,000 in 48 hours. But I am not a big fan of bubble calling. I think of, to me, Peter Lynch had a great line about this. He said, more money has been lost in trying to prepare for bubbles, that more money's been lost than in actual bubbles themselves. So even if these things do exist and they are bubbles, you can get the timing wildly wrong. A great example of that was the housing bubble. People right. say, I predicted it. Lots of people predicted it. Lots of people saying housing was too expensive in 2005 doesn't make you a genius. But it went through 2006 and 2007. Imagine holding that short position on for all that time. So the bubble calling calls getting out near the top and near the bottom to make it profitable whatsoever. So I think it's wisest for investors just to steer clear of that game altogether.
Yeah, and I believe George Soros had always said that's where you have the opportunity to make the most money. And I know you're not that kind of trader. As he was, short term, leverage up and try to make a big call on something. But if you are that kind of person, you might like this kind of activity.
If you're into if you can time the market, do it.
Yeah,
that's how I say it.
Okay, so you are the opposite of that, as I said. You know, you buy and hold stocks for the long term. Your buy list, you reset it annually and don't change it, which I gotta believe was very difficult in 2020.
Very difficult.
And yet, you know, the buy list last year gained nearly 17%. Outpacing the S&P 500, although including dividends, the buy list was a little bit shy at 17.9%. Right. The S&P gained 8.4%, but still, impressive performance given the volatility in a year where your positions were held in lockstep and you couldn't do anything about them. So I guess going into 2021, did you lobby to change that point of view, or you're sticking with that for the new year?
I'm sticking with that point of view, and I'm pretty much a bottom up investor. So I don't go looking in with any sort of macro view. For example, I don't have any energy stocks. So a lot of times people ask me, "Well, is this your view on geopolitics?" No, I just didn't see any energy stocks that I like. So I'm just sort of old fashioned, straight ahead stock picking.
Okay. So let's get to it. And every year you sell five stocks and
buy and sell five in a 25 stock portfolio. So the turnover is 20%, which actually isn't terribly far from the S&P 500, just normal, just through its regular operations, which is usually around 3 to 5, maybe 7%.
Right. So the sells from last year's buy list were Becton Dickinson, Eagle Bank Corp, Globe Life, Hormel Foods, and RPM International. So before we get to the stocks that replaced them, should we read anything into the sales of those individual stocks, either, you know, as a macro call on regional banks with Eagle Bank Corp or Spam with Hormel Foods?
No, not particularly. I wasn't wild about selling two of the financial stocks, but I felt it was the best thing to do. So I wouldn't read a lot into it. I'll give you an example. Becton Dickinson, which is a very fine company. We didn't buy Becton Dickinson. We added C.R. Bard, and then we got Becton Dickinson. And that's always a difficult call because what you like then becomes a very small part of a larger organization. And it's really nothing against Becton, but you know, the story, what we bought is different from what we now have. And that happens a lot with when the decision comes to sell.
Just one other question before we get to the new names. What I found interesting is, correct me if I'm wrong, before the five names that you sold were underperformers in 2020. Good traders, they let their winners run and they cut their losers. And bad traders, kind of like when they have losers, they say, well, the market just hasn't figured it out like I have yet, and they hold on to them. But you're kind of you're cutting bait here and moving on to some new names. Is that a...
I did cut the losers. And again, I think that was mostly due to the financial stocks not doing well, Eagle and Globe. But we did hold on to Aflac, which was also one of the poor performers this year. So I don't have any specific... the performance in the year before doesn't drive the my decision to buy or sell. But a lot of times when they do poorly and earnings wise and business wise, so that can happen. And I think that's what happened this year.
And on the flip side, just because a stock necessarily, you know, does great for you in one year does not necessarily mean you're kind of scared of the altitude and going to unload it.
Exactly. And that's why, so it's five stocks in a 25 stock portfolio. So that means on average, we're going to hold the stock for 5 years. And that I find, I think a lot of investors should think that way. Think, if I'm going to buy this stock, am I going to be happy holding this in 2026? On average. So a lot of things, I don't know what Tesla is going to be in 2026. I have a good idea what Church & Dwight is going to be doing in 2026. So a lot of people think that's a handicap. I actually think it's an advantage.
So a couple of things I wanted to mention, and I wanted to mention this earlier. Full disclosure, I am now a shareholder of the CWS, the Advisor Shares Focused Equity ETF that you manage. Because after your last appearance late last year, I was looking at some of the names that you were talking about and thinking, oh, maybe I'll take a flyer in one of these. And I was like, wait a minute, he's already done the work, and I'll trade it. I'll mess it up, and you know, I'll stick with the guy. So I am a shareholder of the fund. So good, you know, continued success.
Thank you. And that was an outstanding decision on your part. You've already lost weight, and your golf game has improved.
Everything's improved. My whole life, I just feel better overall. But the fact that your average holding period is 5 years, if I'm not mistaken, that's longer than the average tenure of an S&P 500 CEO, right? Isn't the average CEO tenure for the S&P 500 now under 4 years?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, again, and I guess we're really teasing the new names because we haven't mentioned them yet, but what's your process for finding these names, given the kind of volatile world we live in, and forgetting COVID and attempted coups and all that stuff, just the normal course of business in America today?
Well, I like to look for companies that have an enduring competitive advantage, something that separates them apart from other players in the field, something this company can do something that its competitors cannot. For example, it can raise prices, and that not means it will, but it has that ability. It can maintain higher operating margins than its competitors. It has much more flexibility within its marketplace to try new products and invest in different initiatives. So it's the company that is fundamentally apart from the competitors, and hopefully that competitive advantage is enduring. Not just noticeable, but it is enduring, and one that can last for more than one business cycle.
Okay, so with that introduction, the five new stocks for the buy list for 2021 are Abbott Labs, Heiko, Thermo Fisher Scientific, Zoetis or Zoetis?
Zoetis.
A third option, which does pet vaccines. And the one that you wrote about in some detail last week, which is Miller Industries, which I had frankly never heard of. It's by far the smallest market cap name on the buy list. They make towing equipment. So what is it about Miller Industries that you find so compelling?
Well, there's always, you know, most of the names are, you know, mid cap and large cap, you know, Abbott Labs, people have heard of that. Every once in a while in your portfolio, you want to open it up to what I would call kind of an off-road name that's not as familiar, and maybe that is overlooked and not well known. And then this year, that example is Miller Industries. Very cool little company, about $450 million in market cap. They're based down in Tennessee, and they do towing and recovery equipment. And I think most people listening are like, they do what? But that's right. Exactly what they do. And it's an important business, and it's kind of like a dirty job that somebody's got to do it. And there's always a good place to find companies is completely overlooked and ignored industries. They do something that's not that sexy, that doesn't really strike people as important. But if you're in that industry, you need it. And there aren't many other people to go to, but Miller, I believe they have about a 40% market share. It was a highly fragmented industry. And then the founder, Bill Miller, came along, bought up a lot of the smaller players, and was able to sort of standardize the processes across all of these acquisitions, thus making it more efficient. And they've grown and grown, and they had a very tough year last year for obvious reasons. Now, whenever you see problems in the business, you want to ask, is this due to them or is this due to external factors? And I think to a very large extent, it was external factors. It wasn't that Miller had dropped the ball. So therefore, much more likely to suggest we'll see a rebound in Miller Industries. They have no debt. They have strong margins. They've actually, the only downside is they've gotten some attention, some antitrust attention from the government in Washington, but that's kind of understandable. It really is an offshoot of their success. They pay a modest dividend. It's just sort of a well-run industry, I think, going for a very good valuation. And also, this is a very important point. Something that I really love is that, I'll ask you a very leading question. Guess how many Wall Street analysts follow Miller Industries?
I read your write-up, so I know the answer, Stephen.
But yeah, nobody does. So this is the kind of thing you can go. You can for investors who are hobbyists. You know, I understand not everybody's into it, but if you're into this stuff, You can get the 10Q. You can get the 10K. Start reading it. That has everything. I mean, it's the boring pages of the annual report. And then you can know as much as anybody. And you can see this is a very solid, very well-run company. And it has kind of all the things that a long-term, someone with a long-term focus has. So I'm very optimistic for Miller this year and hopefully a few years down the road.
Now, how does a stock like Miller come to your attention? Was there a screen or an article you read somewhere?
People always ask me, are there screens? I just like doing this. And I collect names over the years of kind of odd, you know, companies that I like, that I think are interesting. And then I look if they have an attractive valuation. I'm not a big fan of screeners. To the most, I don't use them, but you know, it would be something like looking at a particular industry and what has larger operating margins. So look at all of the companies that do X, Y, Z, and also, you know, for companies that are able to maintain lower debt loads than the others. But no, it's not a specific formula, just looking for very good companies and good prices.
Interesting. And Zoetis, which I didn't know how to pronounce earlier, symbol ZTS. They make vaccines for pets.
That's right. Huge growing industry.
Right. I would assume this, you're betting on the fact that pet owners, and I'm one, will do anything for our pets. And you know, the amount of money that's being spent is incredible. And Zoetis, do they have, you know, that kind of moat that you look for? Is that what drew you to them?
Yeah. And it's not just pets, but it's also livestock. And also they have an impressive growing international business as well. Someone described it, may have been the CEO, I can't remember, said that in 50 years in America, the dog has gone from outside the house to sleeping outside the house to sleeping inside the house. And now it sleeps in the bed. And that'll probably happen all over the world. And so there's a growing demand for pet needs. And also just the drug business has a lot of mini monopolies with getting the drug names. And Zoetis has been very impressive. So again, it's not just Fluffy and Rex, but it's also livestock animals as well, and not just drugs, but sort of all the wide range of therapeutics for animals. It was spun off by Pfizer, the drug company, a couple of years ago, and very impressive company.
And I see you have two. You have Abbott Labs, of course, and Thermo Fisher. I'm guessing I know what the answer is, but are those all plays having to do anything with COVID?
Not necessarily, no. Okay. Although actually Becton had some very good news about COVID, but Abbott is and Thermo Fisher are very, very large companies. So I know they are working on that. And Abbott just had a recent announcement about its COVID. I forget something
the
about
test kit. The test kit got approved.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I mean, I have no doubt that Abbott would be at the front of the line, but no, it's not a specific COVID play, and I would suggest that that's probably played itself out.
Interesting. And Heiko is an aerospace company.
Cool company. This is it's not absolutely zero followed, but I think the last I checked, maybe four analysts follow it. What they do is they make replacement parts for the aircraft industry. Another good example. Who would do that? But if you own a plane, you want to keep it up in the air. You don't want to go out and buy a new plane. So anything that breaks down, you know, it's so cost efficient to keep that thing up in the air. Remember, a lot of planes that you fly on are very, very old.
Yep.
You really can't go to the original equipment manufacturer. But what you do is you can turn to Heiko and they can make the knockoff and they can do it a lot less expensively. In many ways, I think of it as similar to the model of the generic drug industry. So they just make the cheaper knockoff. Also, one of the things about Heiko is these parts require very strict FAA regulations. You can't just knock it out, but you sort of know what you're doing. And Heiko has the experience on that. So they really know the industry well, and they really are sort of beloved by a lot of their clients. So excellent company. And actually, it was a buy list member a couple of years ago, and I freely admit my mistake. I sold it, and I sold it stupidly. And I've been wanting to, and it's terrible when you sell something and you watch it sail away from you. And some of the dislocations of 2020 have made it a little bit more affordable. So I'm happy to have Heiko back on it. What wonderful company.
And I just wanted to ask you about a name that was on your list last year, and for all I know, the year before, or remains on the list, and that's Disney. We talked about that quite a bit last time. Its store remains near all-time highs. Is there a price level you're looking at? You typically say this is a buy up to a certain number. Mm-hmm. You have a number for Disney?
That's not just a price target. I just use it for a current entry. Right. But you know, I could say is, let's look at the net, you know, the Netflix valuation. What are they going at? I would say maybe if Disney is becoming a streaming company that just sort of has a parks business on the side, which I think is the quote we may have talked about before. If that's what Disney is becoming, maybe that's the kind of valuation they're heading towards. I don't know. I get the feeling that Disney was heading towards becoming what they are now. I think COVID just pushed up those plans by maybe 3 to 5 years. I don't have a target on them, but what a wonderful company. They are just in a great position.
So in a great position. And then I clearly you have no, or do you have any concern just about how far and how fast the stock has run in the last month or so?
I mean, not wild about it seeing it jump up like that, but no, I don't place any judgments on something like that. And again, in the short term, I'm always getting it wrong. I mean, I've had Pfizer for 15 years, and that's gone. If I put an exit, it didn't work with Heiko, and I'll freely admit that it wouldn't have worked with Pfizer. So I won't even venture a guess when Disney will top out, if ever.
All right. Our guest has been Eddie Elfenbein, editor of the Crossing Wall Street blog and manager of the Advisor Shares Focused ETF. Eddie, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eddie.